Harper Audio presents Postern of Fate by Agatha Christie, performed by Hugh Fraser.
Four great gates has the city of Damascus: Postern of Fate, the Desert Gate, Disaster's Cavern, Fort of Fear. Pass not beneath, O caravan, or pass not singing. Have you heard that silence where the birds are dead? Yet something pipeth like a bird? From Gates of Damascus by James Elroy Flecker. Book 1. Chapter 1. Mainly concerning books.
Books, said Tuppence.
She produced the word rather with the effect of a bad-tempered explosion.
What did you say? Said Tommy.
Tuppence looked across the room at him.
I said books, she said.
I see what you mean, said Thomas Beresford. In front of Tuppence there were three large packing cases. From each of them, various books had been extracted. The larger part of them were still filled with books.
It's incredible, said Tuppence.
Well, you mean the room they take up?
Yes.
Are you trying to put them all on the shelves?
I don't know what I'm trying to do, said Tuppence.
That's the awkward part of it. One doesn't know ever exactly what one wants to do.
Oh, dear,
she sighed.
Really?
Said her husband. I should have thought that that was not at all characteristic of you. The trouble with you has always been that you know much too well what you do want to do.
What I mean is, said Tuppence, that here we are, getting older, getting a bit, well, let's face it, definitely rheumatic. Especially when one is stretching, you know, stretching, putting in books, or lifting things down from shelves, or kneeling down to look at the bottom shelves for something, then finding it a bit difficult to get up again.
Yes, yes, said Tommy. That's an account of our general disabilities. Is that what you started to say?
Well, no, it isn't what I started to say. What I started to say was, it was lovely to be able to buy a new home and find just the place we wanted to go and live in, and just the house there we'd always dreamt of having, with a little alteration, of course.
Knocking one or two rooms into each other, said Tommy, and adding to it what you call a veranda, and what your builder calls a lodger, though I prefer to call it a loggia.
And it's going to be very nice, said Tuppence firmly.
When you've done it, I shan't know it. Is that the answer? Said Tommy.
Not at all. All I said was that when you see it finished, you're going to be delighted, and say what an ingenious and clever and artistic wife you have.
All right, said Tommy. I'll remember the right thing to say.
You won't need to remember, said Tuppence. It will burst upon you.
What's that got to do with books? Said Tommy.
Well, we brought two or three cases of books with us. I mean, we sold off the books we didn't much care about. We brought the ones we really couldn't bear to part with. And then, of course, the, what you call them's, oh, I can't remember their name now, but the people who were selling us this house, they didn't want to take a lot of their own things with them. And they said, if we'd like to make an offer, they would leave things, including books. And we came and looked at things,
and we made some offers, said Tommy.
Yes, not as many as they hoped we would make, I expect. Some of the furniture and ornaments were too horrible. Well, fortunately, we didn't have to take those. But when I came and saw the various books, there were some nursery ones, you know, some down in the sitting room, and there were one or two old favourites, my own special favourites. So I thought it'd be such fun to have them. You know, the story of Androcles and the Lion. I remember reading that when I was 8 years old. Andrew Lang.
Tell me, Tuppence, were you clever enough to read at 8 years old?
Yes, said Tuppence. I read at 5 years old. Everybody could when I was young. I didn't know one even had to sort of learn. I mean, somebody would read stories aloud, and you liked them very much, and you remembered where the book went back on the shelf, and you were always allowed to take it out and have a look at it yourself. So you found you were reading it too, without bothering to learn to spell or anything like that. It wasn't so good later, because I've never been able to spell very well, and if somebody had taught me to spell when I was about 4 years old, I can see it would have been very good indeed. My father did teach me to do addition and subtraction and multiplication, of course because he said the multiplication table was the most useful thing you could learn in life. And I learned long division, too.
What a clever man he must have been, said Tommy.
Well, I don't think he was especially clever, said Tuppence. But he was just very, very nice.
Aren't we getting away from the point?
Yes, we are, said Tuppence. Well, as I said, I thought of reading Androcles and the Lion again. It came in a book of stories about animals, I think, by Andrew Lang. Oh, I loved that. And there was a story about A Day in My Life at Eton by an Eton schoolboy. I can't think why I wanted to read that, but I did. It was one of my favorite books. And there were some stories from the classics. And there was Mrs. Molesworth, The Cuckoo Clock, Four Winds Farm. Well, that's all right, said Tommy. No need to give me a whole account of your literary triumphs in early youth. What I mean is, said Tuppence, that you can't get them nowadays. I mean, sometimes you get reprints of them, but they've usually been altered and have different pictures in them. Really, the other day I couldn't recognize Alice in Wonderland when I saw it. Then there are one or two of the old fairy books, Pink, Blue and Yellow. And then, of course, lots of later ones which I'd enjoyed, lots of Stanley Weymans and things like that. There are quite a lot here left behind. All right, said Tommy, you were tempted. You felt it was a good buy. Yes, at least... What do you mean, a good buy? I mean, B-U-Y, said Tommy. Oh, I thought you were going to leave the room and were saying goodbye to me. Not at all, said Tommy. I was deeply interested. Anyway, it was a good B-U-Y, and I got them very cheap, as I tell you, and here they all are, among our own books and others. And we've got such a terrible lot now of books, and the shelves we had made, I don't think they're going to be nearly enough. And what about your special sanctum? Is there room there for more books? No, there isn't, said Tommy. There's not going to be enough for my own. Dear, oh dear, said Tuppence. That's so like us. Do you think we might have to build on an extra room? No, said Tommy. We're going to economize. We said so the day before yesterday, do you remember? Well, that was the day before yesterday, said Tuppence. Time alters. What I'm going to do now is put in these shelves all the books I really can't bear to part with. And then we can look at the others and, well, there might be a children's hospital somewhere, and there might anyway be places which would like books. Or we could sell them, said Tommy. Well, I don't suppose they're the sort of books people would want to buy very much. I don't think there are any books of rare value or anything like that. Well, you never know your luck, said Tommy. Let's hope something out of print will fulfill some bookseller's long-felt want. In the meantime, said Tuppence, we have to put them into the shelves, and look inside them, of course, each time to see whether it's a book I do really want and I can really remember. I'm trying to get them roughly, well, you know what I mean, sort of sorted. I mean, adventure stories, fairy stories, children's stories, and those stories about schools, where the children were always very rich. L.T. Mead, I think. And some of the books we used to read to Deborah when she was small, too. How we all used to love Winnie the Pooh. And there was The Little Grey Hen, too. But I didn't care very much for that. I think you're tiring yourself, said Tommy. I think I should leave off what you're doing now. Well, perhaps I will, said Tuppence. But I think if I could just finish this side of the room, just get the books in here.
Well, I'll help you, said Tommy.
He came over, tilted the case so that the books fell out, gathered up armfuls of them, and went to the shelves and shoved them in. I'm putting the same sized ones together. It looks neater, he said. Oh, I don't call that sorting, said Tuppence. Sorting enough to get on with. We can do more of that later. You know, make everything really nice. We'll sort it on some wet day when we can think of nothing else to do. But the trouble is, we can always think of something else to do. Well now, there's another 7 in there. Now then, there's only this top corner. Just bring me that wooden chair over there, will you? Are its legs strong enough for me to stand on it? And then I can put some on the top shelf. With some care, he climbed on the chair. Tuppence lifted up to him an armful of books. He insinuated them with some care onto the top shelf. Disaster only happened with the last 3, which cascaded to the floor, narrowly missing Tuppence. Oh, said Tuppence, that was painful. Well, I can't help it. You handed me up too many at once. Oh, well, that does look wonderful, said Tuppence, standing back a little. Now then, if you'll just put these in the second shelf from the bottom, there's a gap there. That will finish up this particular caseful anyway. It's a good thing, too. These ones I'm doing this morning aren't really ours. They're the ones we bought. We may find treasures.
Oh, we may, said Tommy.
I think we shall find treasures. I think I really shall find something, something that's worth a lot of money, perhaps.
What do we do then? Sell it?
I expect we'll have to sell it. Yes, said Tuppence. Of course, we might just keep it to show to people. You know, not exactly boasting, but just say, you know, oh yes, we've got really one or two interesting finds. I think we shall make an interesting find, too.
What, one old favorite you've forgotten about?
Not exactly that. I meant something startling, surprising, something that'll make all the difference to our lives.
Oh, Tuppence, said Tommy, what a wonderful mind you've got. Much more likely to find something that's an absolute disaster.
Nonsense, said Tuppence. One must have hope. It's the great thing you have to have in life. Hope. Remember? I'm always full of hope.
I know you are, said Tommy. He sighed. I've often regretted it.
Chapter 2 The Black Arrow. Mrs. Thomas Beresford replaced the cuckoo clock by Mrs. Molesworth, choosing a vacant place on the third shelf from the bottom. The Mrs. Molesworths were congregated here together. Tuppence drew out the tapestry room and held it thoughtfully in her fingers. Or she might read Four Winds Farm. She couldn't remember Four Winds Farm as well as she could remember the cuckoo clock and the tapestry room. Her fingers wandered. Tommy would be back soon. She was getting on. Yes, surely she was getting on. If only she didn't stop and pull out old favorites and read them. Very agreeable, but it took a lot of time. And when Tommy asked her in the evening, when he came home, how things were going, and she said, Oh, very well now, she had to employ a great deal of tact and finesse to prevent him from going upstairs and having a real look at how the bookshelves were progressing. It all took a long time. Getting into a house always took a long time, much longer than one thought. And so many irritating people. Electricians, for instance, who had come and appeared to be displeased with what they had done the last time they came, and took up more large areas in the floor, and with cheerful faces produced more pitfalls for the unwary housewife to walk along and put a foot wrong and be rescued just in time by the unseen electrician who was groping beneath the floor. Sometimes, said Tuppence, I really wish we hadn't left Barton's Acre.
Remember the dining room, Tommy had said, and remember those attics, and remember what happened to the garage, nearly wrecked the car, you know it did.
I suppose we could have had it patched up, said Tuppence.
No, said Tommy. We'd have had to practically replace the damaged building, or else we had to move.
This is going to be a very nice house someday. I'm quite sure of that.
Anyway, there's going to be room in it for all the things we want to do.
When you say the things we want to do, Tuppence had said, you mean the things we want to find places for and to keep.
I know, said Tommy. One keeps far too much. I couldn't agree with you more.
At that moment, Tuppence considered something. Whether they were ever going to do anything with this house, that is to say, beyond getting into it. It sounded simple, but it had turned out complex. Partly, of course, all these books.
If I'd been a nice ordinary child of nowadays, said Tuppence, I wouldn't have learned to read so easily when I was young. Children nowadays who are 4 or 5 or 6 don't seem to be able to read when they get to 10 or 11. I can't think why it was so easy for all of us. We could all read. Me and Martin next door, and Jennifer down the road, and Cyril and Winifred, all of us. I don't mean we could all spell very well, but we could read anything we wanted to. I don't know how we learnt. Asking people, I suppose. Things about posters and Carter's little liver pills. We used to read all about them in the fields when the trains got near London. It was very exciting. I always wondered what they were. Oh dear, I must think of what I'm doing. She removed some more books. 3/4 of an hour passed with her absorbed first in Alice Through the Looking Glass, then with Charlotte Yonge's Unknown to History. Her hands lingered over the fat shabbiness of the daisy chain. Oh, I must read that again, said Tuppence. To think of the years and years and years it is since I did read it. Oh dear, how exciting it was. Wondering, you know, whether Norman was going to be allowed to be confirmed or not. And Ethel, and what was the name of the place? Coxwell, or something like... And Flora, who was worldly. I wonder why everyone was worldly in those days, and how poorly it was thought of, being worldly. I wonder what we are now. Do you think we're all worldly or not?
I beg your pardon, ma'am?
Oh, nothing, said Tuppence, looking round at her devoted henchman, Albert, who had just appeared in the doorway.
I thought you called for something, madam.
And you rang the bell, didn't you?
Oh, not really, said Tuppence. I just leant on it, getting up on a chair, to take a book out.
Is there anything I can take down for you?
I wish you would, said Tuppence. I'm falling off these chairs. Some of their legs are very wobbly. Some of them are rather slippery.
Any book in particular?
Well, I haven't got on very far with the third shelf up, two shelves down from the top, you know. I don't know what books are there.
Albert mounted on a chair, and banging each book in turn to dislodge such dust as it had managed to gather on it, handed things down. Tuppence received them with a good deal of rapture.
Oh, fancy! All these! I really have forgotten a lot of these. Oh, yes, here's the Amulet, and here's the Samiad, here's the New Treasure Seekers. Oh, I love all those. No, don't put them in the shelves yet, Albert. I think I'll have to read them first. Well, I mean one or two of them first, perhaps. Now, what's this one? Let me see. The Red Cockade. Oh, yes, that was one of the historical ones. That was very exciting. And there's Under the Red Robe, too. Lots of Stanley Weyman. Lots and lots. Of course, I used to read those when I was about 10 or 11. I shouldn't be surprised if I don't come across The Prisoner of Zender.
She sighed with enormous pleasure at the remembrance. The Prisoner of Zender. One's first introduction, really, to the romantic novel. The romance of Princess Flavia, the King of Ruritania, Rudolf Rassendil, some name like that, whom one dreamt of at night.
Albert handed down another selection. Oh, yes, said Tuppence. That's better, really.
Well, that's earlier again. I must put all the early ones all together.
Now, let me see. What have we got here? Treasure Island.
Well, that's nice, of course, but I have read Treasure Island again, and I've seen, I think, two films of it. I don't like seeing it on films. It never seems right. And, oh, here's Kidnapped. Yes, I always liked that.
Albert stretched up, overdid his armful, and Catriona fell more or less on Tuppence's head.
Oh, sorry, madam. Very sorry. It's quite all right, said Tuppence. Doesn't matter. Catriona, yes. Any more Stevensons up there?
Albert handed the books down, now more gingerly. Tuppence uttered a cry of excessive delight.
The Black Arrow! I declare, the Black Arrow! Now that's one of the first books, really, I ever got hold of and read.
Yes. I don't suppose you ever did, Albert. I mean, you wouldn't have been born, would you? Now, let me think. Let me think. The Black Arrow.
Yes, of course, it was that picture on the wall with eyes, real eyes, looking through the eyes of the picture. It was splendid. So frightening. Just that. Oh, yes, the Black Arrow. What was it? It was all about... Oh, yes, the cat.
The dog?
No, the cat, the rat, and Lovell, the dog. Rule all England under the hog. That's it. The hog was Richard III, of course.
Though nowadays they all write books saying he was really wonderful. Not a villain at all. But I don't believe that. Shakespeare didn't either. After all, he started his play by making Richard say, I am determined so to prove a villain.
Ah, yes. The Black Arrow. Some more, madam?
No, thank you, Albert. I think I'm rather too tired to go on now.
Well, that's all right. By the way, the master rang and said he'd be half an hour late.
Never mind, said Tuppence.
She sat down in the chair, took the Black Arrow, opened the pages, and engrossed herself.
Oh, dear, she said, how wonderful this is. I've really forgotten it quite enough to enjoy reading it all over again. It was so exciting.
Silence fell. Albert returned to the kitchen. Tuppence leaned back in the chair. Time passed. Curled up in the rather shabby armchair, Mrs. Thomas Beresford sought the joys of the past by applying herself to the perusal of Robert Louis Stevenson's The Black Arrow. In the kitchen, time also passed. Albert applied himself to the various manoeuvres with the stove. A car drove up. Albert went to the side door.
Shall I put it in the garage, sir?
No, said Tommy. I'll do that. I expect you're busy with dinner.
Am I very late?
Oh, not really, sir.
Just about when you said.
A little early, in fact.
Oh.
Tommy disposed of the car and then came into the kitchen, rubbing his hands. Cold out? Where's Tuppence?
Oh, Missus, she's upstairs with the books.
What, still those miserable books?
Yeah, she's done a good many more today and she's spent most of the time reading.
Oh, dear. Said Tommy. All right, Albert. What are we having?
Fillets of lemon sole, sir.
It won't take long to do.
All right. Well, make it about a quarter of an hour or so, anyway. I want to wash first.
Upstairs, on the top floor, Tuppence was still sitting in the somewhat shabby armchair engrossed in the Black Arrow. Her forehead was slightly wrinkled.
She had come across what seemed to her a somewhat curious phenomenon. There seemed to be what she could only call a kind of interference. The particular page she had got to, she gave it a brief glance, 64, or was it 65, she couldn't see. Anyway, apparently somebody had underlined some of the words on the page. Tuppence had spent the last quarter of an hour studying this phenomenon. She didn't see why the words had been underlined. They were not in sequence. They were not a quotation, therefore, in the book. They seemed to be words that had been singled out and had then been underlined in red ink. She read under her breath. Matcham could not restrain a little cry. Dick started with surprise and dropped the Windac from his fingers. They were all afoot, losing sword and dagger in the sheath. Ellis held up his hand. The white of his eyes shone. Tuffin shook her head. It didn't make sense. None of it did. She went over to the table where she kept her writing things, picked out a few sheets recently sent by a firm of notepaper printers for the Beresfords to make a choice of the paper to be stamped with their new address, the Laurels. Silly name, said Tuppence, but if you go changing names all the time, then all your letters go astray. She copied things down. Now she realized something she hadn't realized before. Well, that makes all the difference, said Tuppence. She traced the letters on the page. Oh, so there you are, said Tommy's voice suddenly. Dinner's practically in. How are the books going? Well, this lot's terribly puzzling, said Tuppence. Dreadfully puzzling. Well, what's puzzling? Well, this is the Black Arrow of Stevenson's, and I wanted to read it again, and I began. It was all right. And then suddenly, all the pages were rather queer, because, I mean, a lot of the words had been underlined in red ink. Oh, well, one does that, said Tommy. I don't mean solely in red ink, but I mean one does underline things. You know, something you want to remember. Or a quotation or something. Well, you know what I mean. Well, I know what you mean, said Tuppence, but it doesn't go like that. And it's letters, you see. Well, what do you mean by letters? Well, come here, said Tuppence. Tommy came and sat on the arm of the chair. Tommy read, Matcham could not restrain a little cry. And even Dyed Starter started with surprise and dropped the window from his fingers. The two big fellows on the, something I can't read, shell was an expected signal. They were all afoot together, tightening, loosing sword and dagger. It's mad, he said. Yes, said Tuppence. That's what I thought at first. It was mad. But it isn't mad, Tommy. Some cowbells rang from downstairs. Are that supper in? Never mind, said Tuppence. I've got to tell you this first. We can get down to things about it later, but it's really so extraordinary. I've got to tell you this straight away. Oh, all right. Have you got one of your mare's nests? No, I haven't. It's just that I took out the letters, you see. Well, on this page, you see, well, the M of Matcham, which is the first word. The M is underlined, and the A, and after that there are three or four more words. They don't come in sequence in the book. They've just been picked out, I think. And they've been underlined, the letters in them, because they wanted the right letters, and the next one, you see, is the R from restrain, underlined, and the Y of cry. And then there's J from Jack, O from shot, R from ruin, D from death, A from death again, N from moraine. For goodness sake, said Tommy, do stop. Wait, said Tuppence. I've got to find out. Now, you see, because I've written out these, do you see what this is? I mean, if you take those letters out, and write them in order on this piece of paper. Do you see what you get with the ones I've done first? M-A-R-Y. Those four were underlined. Well, what does that make? It makes Mary. All right, said Tommy, it makes Mary. Somebody called Mary. A child with an inventive nature, I expect, who's trying to point out that this was her book. People are always writing their names in books and things like that. All right, Mary, said Tuppence. And the next thing that comes underlined makes the word J-O-R-D-A-N. Oh, you see, Mary Jordan, said Tommy. It's quite natural. Now you know her whole name. Her name was Mary Jordan. Well, this book didn't belong to her. In the beginning, it says in a rather silly, childish-looking writing, it says Alexander Parkinson, I think. Oh, well, does it really matter? Of course it matters, said Tuppence. Come on, I'm hungry, said Tommy. Restrain yourself, said Tuppence.
I'm only going to read you the next bit until the writing stops, or at any rate stops in the next four pages. The letters are picked from odd places, on various pages. They don't run in sequence. There can't be anything in the words that matters. It's just the letters. Now then, we've got M-A-R-Y-J-O-R-D-A-N. That's right. Now, do you know what the next four words are? D-I-D-N-O-T, not D-I-E. N-A-T-U-R-A-L-Y. That's meant to be double L-Y, but they didn't know it had two L's. Now then, what's that? Mary Jordan did not die naturally. There you are, said Tuppence. Now the next sentence I made is, it was one of us. I think I know which one. That's all. Can't find anything else, but it is rather exciting, isn't it?
Oh, look here, Tuppence, said Tommy. You're not going to get a thing about this, are you?
What do you mean, a thing about this?
Well, I mean, working up a sort of mystery.
Well, it's a mystery to me, said Tuppence. Mary Jordan did not die naturally. It was one of us. I think I know which. Oh, Tommy, you must say that it is very intriguing.
Chapter 3 Visit to the Cemetery.
Tuppence! Tommy called as he came into the house.
There was no answer. With some annoyance, he ran up the stairs and along the passage on the first floor. As he hastened along it, he nearly put his foot through a gaping hole and swore promptly.
Some other bloody careless electrician, he said.
Some days before, he had had the same kind of trouble. Electricians, arriving in a kindly tangle of optimism and efficiency, had started work.
Coming along fine now. Not much more to do, they said. We'll be back this afternoon.
But they hadn't been back that afternoon. Tommy was not precisely surprised. He was used now to the general pattern of labour in the building trade, electrical trade, gas employees and others. They came, they showed efficiency, they made optimistic remarks, they went away to fetch something. They didn't come back. One rang up numbers on the telephone, but they always seemed to be the wrong numbers. If they were the right numbers, the right man was not working at this particular branch of the trade, whatever it was. All one had to do was to be careful not to rick an ankle, fall through a hole, damage yourself in some way or another, although he was far more afraid of Tuppence damaging herself than he was of doing the damage to himself. He had had more experience than Tuppence. Tuppence, he thought, was more at risk from scalding herself from kettles or disasters with the heat of the stove. But where was Tuppence now? He called again.
Tuppence! Tuppence!
He worried about Tuppence. Tuppence was one of those people you had to worry about. If you left the house, you gave her last words of wisdom, and she gave you last promises of doing exactly what you counseled her to do. No, she would not be going out except just to buy half a pound of butter. And after all, you couldn't call that dangerous, could you?
It could be dangerous if you went out to buy half a pound of butter.
Oh, said Tuppence, don't be an idiot.
I'm not being an idiot. I'm just being a wise and careful husband, looking after something which is one of my favourite possessions. I don't know why it is, because I'm so charming, so good-looking, such a good companion, and because I take so much care of you.
That also may be, but I could give you another list. I don't feel I should like that. No, I don't think so. I think you have several saved-up grievances. But don't worry, everything will be quite all right. You've only got to come back and call me when you get in.
But now, where was Tuppence?
The little devil, thought Tommy. She's gone out somewhere. He went on into the room upstairs, where he had found her before, looking at another child's book, he supposed, getting excited again about some silly words that a silly child had underlined in red ink, on the trail of Mary Jordan, whoever she was. Mary Jordan, who hadn't died a natural death. He couldn't help wondering. A long time ago, presumably, the people who'd had the house and sold it to them had been named Jones. They hadn't been there very long. Only 3 or 4 years. No, this child of the Robert Louis Stevenson book dated from further back than that. Anyway, Tuppence wasn't here in this room. There seemed to be no loose books lying about with signs of having had interest shown in them.
Where the hell can she be?
Said Thomas. He went downstairs again, shouting once or twice. There was no answer. He examined one of the pegs in the hall. No signs of Tuppence's Macintosh.
Well, then she must have gone out. Where had she gone? And where was Hannibal? Tommy varied the use of his vocal cords and called out for Hannibal.
Hannibal! Hannibal! Hanny boy! Come on, Hannibal!
No Hannibal. Well, at any rate, she's got Hannibal with her, thought Tommy. He didn't know if it was worse or better that Tuppence should have Hannibal. Hannibal would certainly allow no harm to come to Tuppence. The question was, might Hannibal do some damage to other people? He was friendly when taken visiting people, but people who wished to visit Hannibal, to enter any house in which he lived, were always definitely suspect in Hannibal's mind. He was ready at all risks to both bark and bite if he considered it necessary. Anyway, where was everybody? He walked a little way along the street, could see no signs of any small black dog with a medium-sized woman in a bright red Macintosh walking in the distance. Finally, rather angrily, he came back to the house. Rather an appetizing smell met him. He went quickly to the kitchen, where Tuppence turned from the stove and gave him a smile of welcome.
"You're ever so late," she said. "This is a casserole. Smells rather good, don't you think? I put some rather unusual things in it this time. There were some herbs in the garden. At least, I hope they were herbs."
"If they weren't herbs," said Tommy, "I suppose they were deadly nightshade or digitalis leaves, pretending to be something else but really foxglove.
Where on earth have you been?" "I took Hannibal for a walk."
Hannibal, at this moment, made his own presence felt. He rushed at Tommy and gave him such a rapturous welcome as nearly felled him to the ground. Hannibal was a small, black dog, very glossy, with interesting tan patches on his behind and each side of his cheeks. He was a Manchester Terrier, a very pure pedigree, and he considered himself to be on a much higher level of sophistication and aristocracy than any other dog he met.
"Oh, goodness gracious!
I took a look round.
Where have you been? It wasn't very nice weather."
"No, it wasn't. It was sort of foggy and misty."
"Ah, I'm quite tired, too. Oh, where did you go? Just down the street for the shops?"
"No, it's early closing day for the shops. I went to the cemetery."
"Sounds gloomy," said Tommy.
"What did you want to go to the cemetery for?"
"Oh, I went to look at some of the graves."
"Well, it still sounds rather gloomy," said Tommy. "Did Hannibal enjoy himself?"
"Well, I had to put Hannibal on the lead. There was something that looked like a verger who kept coming out of the church, and I thought he wouldn't like Hannibal because, well, you never know. Hannibal mightn't like him, and I didn't want to prejudice people against us the moment we'd arrived."
"What did you want to look in the cemetery for?"
"Oh, to see what sort of people were buried there. Well, lots of people. I mean, it's very, very full up. It goes back a long way. It goes back well into the 1800s, and I think one or two graves are older than that. Only the stone's so rubbed away you can't really see."
"I still don't see why you wanted to go to the cemetery."
"I was making my investigations," said Tuppence.
"Investigations about what?"
"I wanted to see if there were any Jordans buried there."
"Good gracious," said Tommy. "Are you still on that? Were you looking for—"
"Well, Mary Jordan died. We know she died. We know because we had a book that said she didn't die a natural death. But she'd still have to be buried somewhere, wouldn't she?"
"Undeniably," said Tommy. "Unless she was buried in this garden."
"Well, I don't think that's very likely," said Tuppence. "Because I think that it was only this boy or girl. It must have been a boy, I think. Well, of course, it was a boy. His name was Alexander, and he obviously thought he'd been rather clever in knowing that she'd not died a natural death. But if he was the only person who'd made up his mind about that, or who discovered it, well, I mean, nobody else had, I suppose. I mean, she just died and was buried, and nobody said—"
"Nobody said there had been foul play," suggested Tommy.
"Well, that sort of thing, yes. Poisoned, or knocked on the head, or pushed off a cliff, or run over by a car, or—" "Oh, lots of ways I can think of."
"I'm sure you can," said Tommy. "Only good thing about you, Tuppence, is that at least you have a kindly heart. You wouldn't put them into execution just for fun."
"But there wasn't any Mary Jordan in the cemetery. There weren't any Jordans."
"Disappointing for you," said Tommy. "Is that thing you're cooking ready yet? Because I'm pretty hungry. It smells rather good."
"It's absolutely done à point," said Tuppence. "So, as soon as you've washed, we eat."
Chapter 4 Lots of Parkinson's.
"Lots of Parkinson's," said Tuppence as they ate. A long way back, but an amazing lot of them. Old ones, young ones, and married ones, bursting with Parkinson's. And Capes, and Griffins, and Underwoods, and Overwoods. Curious to have both of them, isn't it?
I had a friend called George Underwood, said Tommy.
Yes, I've known Underwoods, too, but not Overwoods.
Male or female? Said Thomas, with slight interest.
A girl, I think it was. Rose Overwood.
Rose Overwood, said Tommy, listening to the sound of it. I don't think somehow it goes awfully well together. He added, I must ring up those electricians after lunch. Be very careful, Tuppence, or you'll put your foot through the landing upstairs. Well, then I shall be a natural death. Or an unnatural death, one of the two.
A curiosity death, said Tommy. Curiosity killed the cat.
Aren't you at all curious? Asked Tuppence.
I can't see any earthly reason for being curious.
What have we got for pudding? Treacle tart.
Well, I must say, Tuppence, it was a delicious meal.
I'm very glad you liked it, said Tuppence.
What is that parcel outside the back door? Is it that wine we ordered?
No, said Tuppence. It's bulbs.
Oh, said Tommy. Bulbs?
Tulips, said Tuppence.
I'll go and talk to old Isaac about them.
Where are you going to put them?
Well, I think along the centre path in the garden.
Poor old fellow. He looks as if he might drop dead any minute, said Tommy.
Not at all, said Tuppence. He's enormously tough, is Isaac. I've discovered, you know, that gardeners are like that. If they're very good gardeners, they seem to come to their prime when they're over 80. But if you get a strong, hefty-looking young man, about 35, who says, I've always wanted to work in a garden, you may be quite sure that he's probably no good at all. They're just prepared to brush up a few leaves now and again, and anything you want them to do, they always say it's the wrong time of year. And as one never knows oneself when the right time of year is, at least I don't, well then, you see, they always get the better of you. But Isaac's wonderful. He knows about everything. Tuppence added, there ought to be some crocuses as well. I wonder if they're in the parcel too. Well, I'll go out and see. It's his day for coming, and he'll tell me all about it.
All right, said Tommy. I'll come out and join you presently.
Tuppence and Isaac had a pleasant reunion. The bulbs were unpacked. Discussions were held as to where things would show to best advantage. First, the early tulips, which were expected to rejoice the heart at the end of February. Then, a consideration of the handsome fringed parrot tulips. And some tulips called, as far as Tuppence could make out, viridiflora, which would be exceptionally beautiful with long stems in the month of May and early June. As these were of an interesting green pastel colour, they agreed to plant them as a collection in a quiet part of the garden, where they could be picked and then arranged in interesting floral arrangements for the drawing room, or by the short approach to the house through the front gate, where they would arouse envy and jealousy among callers. They might even rejoice the artistic feelings of tradesmen delivering joints of meat and crates of grocery. At 4 o'clock, Tuppence produced a brown teapot full of good, strong tea in the kitchen, placed a sugar basin full of lumps of sugar and a milk jug by it, and called Isaac in to refresh himself before departing. She went in search of Tommy. I suppose he's asleep somewhere, thought Tuppence to herself, as she looked from one room into another. She was glad to see a head sticking up on the landing out of the sinister pit in the floor.
It's all right now, ma'am, said the electrician. No need to be careful any more. It's all fixed.
He added that he was starting work on a different portion of the house on the following morning. I do hope, said Tuppence, that you will really come. She added, have you seen Mr. Beresford anywhere?
Oh, your husband, you mean? Yes, he's up on an upper floor, I think. Dropping things, he was. Yes, rather heavy things, too. Must have been some books, I think.
Books, said Tuppence. Well, I never. The electrician retreated down into his own personal underworld in the passage, and Tuppence went up to the attic, converted to the extra book library, at present devoted to children's books. Tommy was sitting on top of a pair of steps. Several books were around him on the floor, and there were noticeable gaps in the shelves. So there you are, said Tuppence. After pretending you weren't interested or anything, you've been looking at lots of books, haven't you? You've disarranged a lot of the things I put away so neatly.
Well, I'm sorry about that, said Tommy. But, well, I thought I'd perhaps just have a look round.
Did you find any other books that have got any underlined things in them, in red ink?
No, nothing else.
How annoying, said Tuppence.
I think it must have been Alexander's work. Master Alexander Parkinson, said Tommy.
That's right, said Tuppence. One of the Parkinsons. The numerous Parkinsons.
Well, I think he must have been rather a lazy boy. Although, of course, it must have been rather a bother doing that underlining and all. But there's no more information re Jordan, said Tommy.
I asked old Isaac. He knows a lot of people round here. He says he doesn't remember any Jordans.
What are you doing with that brass lamp you've got by the front door? Asked Tommy, as he came downstairs.
I'm taking it to the White Elephant sale, said Tuppence.
Why?
Oh, because it's always been a thorough nuisance. We bought it somewhere abroad, didn't we?
Yes, I think we must have been mad.
You never liked it.
You said you hated it.
Well, I agree. And it's awfully heavy, too, very heavy. But Miss Sanderson was terribly pleased when I said they could have it. She offered to fetch it. But I said I'd run it down to them in the car. It's today we take the thing.
Well, I'll run down with it if you like.
No, I'd rather like to go.
All right, said Tommy. Perhaps I'd better come with you and just carry it in for you.
Oh, I think I'll find someone who'll carry it in for me, said Tuppence.
Well, you might or might not. Don't go and strain yourself.
All right, said Tuppence.
You've got some other reason for wanting to go, haven't you?
Well, I just thought I'd like a bit of a chat with people, said Tuppence.
I never know what you're up to, Tuppence, but I know the look in your eye when you are up to something.
You take Hannibal for a walk, said Tuppence. I can't take him to the White Elephant sale. I don't want to get into a dogfight.
All right. Want to go for a walk, Hannibal?
Hannibal, as was his habit, immediately replied in the affirmative. His affirmatives and his negatives were always quite impossible to miss. He wriggled his body, wagged his tail, raised one paw, put it down again, and came and rubbed his head hard against Tommy's leg.
That's right, he obviously said. That's what you exist for, my dear slave. We're going out for a lovely walk down the street. Lots of smells, I hope.
Come on, said Tommy. I'll take the lead with me. And don't run into the road as you did the last time. One of those awful great long vehicles was nearly the end of you.
Hannibal looked at him with the expression of, I'm always a very good dog who'll do exactly what I'm told. False as the statement was, it often succeeded in deceiving even those people who were in closest contact with Hannibal. Tommy put the brass lamp into the car, murmuring it was rather heavy. Tuppence drove off in the car. Having seen her turn the corner, Tommy attached the lead to Hannibal's collar and took him down the street. Then he turned up the lane towards the church and removed Hannibal's lead, since very little traffic came up this particular road. Hannibal acknowledged the privilege by grunting and sniffing in various tufts of grass with which the pavement next to the wall was adorned. If he could have used human language, it was clear what he would have said. Delicious. Very rich. Big dog here. Believe it's that beastly Alsatian. Low growl. I don't like Alsatians. If I see the one again that bit me once, I'll bite him. Ah, delicious. Delicious. Very nice little bitch here. Yes. Yes, I'd like to meet her. I wonder if she lives far away. Expect she comes out of this house. I wonder now.
Come out of that gate now, said Tommy.
Don't go into a house that isn't yours. Hannibal pretended not to hear.
Hannibal!
Hannibal redoubled his speed and turned a corner which led towards the kitchen.
Hannibal!
Shouted Tommy.
Do you hear me?
Hear you, master, said Hannibal. Were you calling me?
Oh, yes, yes, of course.
A sharp bark from inside the kitchen caught his ear. He scampered out to join Tommy. Hannibal walked a few inches behind Tommy's heel.
Good boy, said Tommy.
I am a good boy, aren't I? Said Hannibal. Any moment you need me to defend you, here I am, less than a foot away. They had arrived at a side gate which led into the churchyard. Hannibal, who in some way had an extraordinary knack of altering his size when he wanted to, instead of appearing somewhat broad-shouldered, possibly a somewhat too plump dog, he could at any moment make himself like a thin black thread. He now squeezed himself through the bars of the gate with no difficulty at all.
Come back, Hannibal, cried Tommy. You can't go into the churchyard.
Hannibal's answer to that, if there had been any, would have been, I'm in the churchyard already, master. He was scampering gaily round the churchyard with the air of a dog who has been let out in a singularly pleasant garden.
You awful dog, said Tommy.
He unlatched the gate,
walked in and chased Hannibal, lead in hand. Hannibal was now at the far corner of the churchyard and seemed to have every intention of trying to gain access through the door of the church, which was slightly ajar. Tommy, however, reached him in time and attached the lead. Hannibal looked up with the air of one who had intended this to happen all along.
"Putting me on the lead, are you?" he said.
"Yes, of course, I know. It's a kind of prestige. It shows that I'm a very valuable dog." He wagged his tail. Since there seemed nobody to oppose Hannibal walking in the churchyard with his master, suitably secured as he was by a stalwart lead, Tommy wandered round, checking perhaps Tuppence's researches of a former day. He looked first at a worn stone monument, more or less behind a little side door into the church. It was, he thought, probably one of the oldest. There were several of them there, most of them bearing dates in the 1800s. There was one, however, that Tommy looked at longest.
"Odd," he said. "Damned odd."
Hannibal looked up at him. He did not understand this piece of master's conversation. He saw nothing about the gravestone to interest a dog. He sat down and looked up at his master inquiringly. Chapter 5 The White Elephant Sale. Tuppence was pleasurably surprised to find the brass lamp which she and Tommy now regarded with such repulsion welcomed with the utmost warmth.
"How very good of you, Mrs. Beresford, to bring us something as nice as that. Most interesting, most interesting. I suppose it must have come from abroad on your travels once."
"Yes, we bought it in Egypt," said Tuppence. She was quite doubtful by this time, a period of 8 or 10 years having passed as to where she had bought it. It might have been Damascus, she thought, and it might equally well have been Baghdad, or possibly Tehran. But Egypt, she thought, since Egypt was doubtless in the news at this moment, would be far more interesting. Besides, it looked rather Egyptian. Clearly, if she had got it from any other country, it dated from some period when they had been copying Egyptian work.
"Really," she said, "it's rather big for our house, so I thought—" "Oh, I think we really ought to raffle it," said Miss Little.
Miss Little was more or less in charge of things. Her local nickname was the Parish Pump, mainly because she was so well informed about all things that happened in the parish. Her surname was misleading. She was a large woman of ample proportions. Her Christian name was Dorothy, but she was always called Dotty.
"I hope you're coming to the sale, Mrs. Beresford."
Tuppence assured her that she was coming.
"I can hardly wait to buy," she said chattily.
"No, I'm so glad you feel like that."
"I think it's a very good thing," said Tuppence. "I mean, the white elephant idea, because it's, well, it's so true, isn't it? I mean, what's one person's white elephant is somebody else's pearl beyond price."
"Ah, really? We must tell that to the vicar,"
said Miss Price Ridley, an angular lady with a lot of teeth.
"Oh, yes, I'm sure he'd be very much amused."
"Or that papier-mâché basin, for instance," said Tuppence, raising this particular trophy up.
"Oh, really? Do you think anyone will buy that?"
"I shall buy it myself if it's up for sale when I come here tomorrow," said Tuppence.
"Oh, but nowadays they have such pretty plastic washing-up bowls."
"I'm not very fond of plastic," said Tuppence. "That's a really good papier-mâché bowl that you got there. I mean, if you put things down in that, lots of china together, they wouldn't break. And there's an old-fashioned tin opener, too, the kind with a bull's head that one never sees nowadays. Oh, but it's such hard work, that. Don't you think the ones that you put on an electric thing are much better?"
Conversation on these lines went on for a short time, and then Tuppence asked if there were any services that she could render.
"Ah, dear Mrs. Beresford, perhaps you would arrange the curio stall. I'm sure you're very artistic."
"Not really very artistic at all," said Tuppence, "but I would love to arrange the stall for you. You must tell me if I'm doing it wrong," she added.
"Oh, it's so nice to have some extra help. We're so pleased to meet you, too. I suppose you're nearly settled in your house by now?"
"I thought we should be settled by now," said Tuppence, "but it seems as though there's a long time to go still. It's so very hard with electricians and then carpenters and people. They're always coming back." A slight dispute arose with people near her supporting the claims of electricians and the gas board.
"Gas people are the worst," said Miss Little, with firmness, "because, you see, they come all the way over from Lower Stamford. The electricity people only have to come from Wellbank."
The arrival of the vicar to say a few words of encouragement and good cheer to the helpers changed the subject. He also expressed himself very pleased to meet his new parishioner, Mrs. Beresford.
Oh, we know all about you, he said. Oh, yes, indeed, and your husband. A most interesting talk I had the other day about you both. What an interesting life you must have had. I dare say it's not supposed to be spoken of, so I won't. I mean, in the last war. A wonderful performance on you and your husband's part.
Oh, do tell us, Vicar, said one of the ladies, detaching herself from the stall where she was setting up jars of jam.
I was told in strict confidence, said the vicar. I think I saw you walking round the churchyard yesterday, Mrs. Beresford.
Yes, said Tuppence. I looked into the church first. I see you have one or two very attractive windows.
Yes, yes, they date back to the 14th century. That is, the one in the North Aisle does, but of course most of them are Victorian.
Walking round the churchyard, said Tuppence, it seemed to me there were a great many Parkinsons buried there.
Yes, yes, indeed. There have always been big contingents of Parkinsons in this part of the world, though, of course, I don't remember any of them myself. But you do, I think, Mrs. Lupton?
Mrs. Lupton, an elderly lady who was supporting herself on two sticks, looked pleased.
Yes, yes, she said. I remember when Mrs. Parkinson was alive. You know, old Mrs. Parkinson, the Mrs. Parkinson who lived in the manor house. Wonderful old lady she was, quite wonderful.
And there were some Summers, I saw, and the Chattertons.
Ah, I see you're getting up well with our local geography of the past.
I think I heard something about a Jordan. Annie or Mary Jordan, was it?
Tuppence looked round her in an inquiring fashion. The name of Jordan seemed to cause no particular interest.
Well, somebody had a cook called Jordan, I think. Mrs. Blackwell. Susan Jordan, I think it was. She only stayed 6 months, I think. Quite unsatisfactory in many ways.
Was that a long time ago?
Oh, no, just about 8 or 10 years ago, I think. Not more than that.
Are there any Parkinsons living here now?
Oh, no. They're all gone long ago. One of them married a first cousin and went to live in Kenya, I believe.
I wonder, said Tuppence, managing to attach herself to Mrs. Lupton, who she knew had something to do with the local children's hospital. I wonder if you want any extra children's books. They're all old ones, I mean. I got them in an odd lot when we were bidding for some furniture that was for sale in our house.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you, I'm sure, Mrs. Beresford.
Of course, we do have some very good ones given to us, you know. Special editions for children nowadays. One does feel it's a pity they should have to read all those old-fashioned books.
Oh, do you think so? Said Tuppence. I loved the books that I had as a child. Some of them, she said, had been my grandmother's when she was a child. I believe I liked those best of all. I shall never forget reading Treasure Island, Mrs. Molesworth's Four Winds Farm, and some of Stanley Weyman's.
She looked round her inquiringly. Then, resigning herself, she looked at her wristwatch, exclaimed at finding how late it was, and took her leave. Tuppence, having got home, put the car away in the garage and walked round the house to the front door. The door was open, so she walked in. Albert then came from the back premises and bowed to greet her.
Like some tea, madam? You must be very tired.
I don't think so, said Tuppence. I've had tea. They gave me tea down at the Institute. Quite good cake, but very nasty buns.
Buns is difficult. Buns is nearly as difficult as doughnuts.
Ah, he sighed.
Lovely doughnuts Amy used to make.
I know. Nobody's were like them, said Tuppence.
Amy had been Albert's wife, now some years deceased.
In Tuppence's opinion, Amy had made wonderful treacle tart, but had never been very good with doughnuts.
I think doughnuts are dreadfully difficult, said Tuppence.
I've never been able to do them myself.
Well, it's a knack.
Where's Mr. Beresford?
Is he out?
Oh, no, he's upstairs in that room. You know, the book room, or whatever you like to call it.
I can't get out of the way of calling it the attic still, myself.
What's he doing up there?
Said Tuppence, slightly surprised.
Well, he's still looking at the books, I think.
I suppose he's still arranging them, getting them finished, as you might say.
Still, seems to me very surprising, said Tuppence.
He's really been very rude to us about those books.
Ah, well, said Albert. Gentlemen are like that, aren't they? They likes big books, mostly, you know, don't they? Something scientific they can get their teeth into.
Shall I go up and rout him out? Said Tuppence.
Where's Hannibal?
I think he's up there with the master.
But at that moment Hannibal made his appearance. Having barked with the ferocious fury he considered necessary for a good guard dog, he had correctly assumed that it was his beloved mistress who had returned, and not someone who had come to steal the teaspoons or to assault his master and mistress. He came wriggling down the stairs, his pink tongue hanging out, his tail wagging.
"Ah," said Tuppence. "Pleased to see your mother?"
Hannibal said he was very pleased to see his mother. He leapt upon her with such force that he nearly knocked her to the ground.
"Gently," said Tuppence. "Gently, you don't want to kill me, do you?"
Hannibal made it clear that the only thing he wanted to do was to eat her, because he loved her so much.
"Where's Master? Where's Father? Is he upstairs?"
Hannibal understood. He ran up a flight, turned his head over his shoulder, and waited for Tuppence to join him.
"Well, I never," said Tuppence, as, slightly out of breath, she entered the bookroom to see Tommy astride a pair of steps, taking books in and out. "Whatever are you doing? I thought you were going to take Hannibal for a walk."
"Well, we've been for a walk," said Tommy. "We went to the churchyard."
"Why on earth did you take Hannibal into the churchyard? I'm sure they wouldn't like dogs there."
"Oh, he was on the lead," said Tommy. "And anyway, I didn't take him, he took me. He seemed to like the churchyard."
"I hope he hasn't got a thing about it," said Tuppence. "You know what Hannibal's like. He likes arranging a routine always. If he's going to have a routine of going to the churchyard every day, it'll really be very difficult for us."
"He's really been very intelligent about the whole thing," said Tommy.
"When you say intelligent, you just mean he's been self-willed," said Tuppence. Hannibal turned his head and came and rubbed his nose against the calf of her leg.
"He's telling you," said Tommy, "that he is a very clever dog, cleverer than you or I have been so far."
"And what do you mean by that?" asked Tuppence.
"Have you been enjoying yourself?"
asked Tommy, changing the subject.
"Well, I wouldn't go as far as that," said Tuppence.
"People were very kind to me, and nice to me, and I think soon I shan't get them mixed up quite so much as I do at present.
It's awfully difficult at first, you know, because people look rather alike and wear the same sort of clothes, and you don't know at first which is which. I mean, unless somebody is very beautiful or very ugly. And that doesn't seem to happen so noticeably in the country, does it?"
"I'm telling you," said Tommy, "that Hannibal and I have been extremely clever."
"I thought you said it was Hannibal."
Tommy reached out his hand and took a book from the shelf in front of him.
"Kidnapped," he remarked. "Oh yes, another Robert Louis Stevenson. Somebody must have been very fond of Robert Louis Stevenson. The Black Arrow, Kidnapped, Catriona, and two others, I think, all given to Alexander Parkinson by a fond grandmother. Oh, and one from a generous aunt."
"Well," said Tuppence, "what about it?"
"And I found his grave," said Tommy.
"Found what?"
"Well, Hannibal did. It's right in the corner against one of the small doors into the church. I suppose it's the other door to the vestry, or something like that. It's very rubbed and not well kept up, but that's it. He was 14 when he died. Alexander Richard Parkinson. Hannibal was nosing about there. I got him away from it and managed to make out the inscription in spite of its being so rubbed."
14, said Tuppence. "Poor little boy."
"Yes," said Tommy. "It's sad and..."
"You've got something in your head," said Tuppence. "I don't understand."
"Well, I wondered. I suppose, Tuppence, you've infected me. That's the worst of you. When you get keen on something, you don't go on with it by yourself. You get somebody else to take an interest in it, too."
"I don't quite know what you mean," said Tuppence.
"But I wondered if it was a case of cause and effect."
"What do you mean, Tommy?"
"I was wondering about Alexander Parkinson, who took a lot of trouble, though no doubt he enjoyed himself doing it, making a kind of code, a secret message in a book. Mary Jordan did not die naturally. Well, supposing that was true? Supposing Mary Jordan, whoever she was, didn't die naturally? Well, then, don't you see, perhaps the next thing that happened was that Alexander Parkinson died."
"Well, you don't mean... you don't think..."
"Well, one wonders," said Tommy. "It started me wondering. 14 years old. There was no mention of what he died of. Well, I suppose there wouldn't be on a gravestone. There was just a text. 'In thy presence is the fullness of joy.' Something like that. But it might have been because he knew something that was dangerous to somebody else, and so he died."
"You mean he was killed?"
"Well, you're just imagining things," said Tuppence. "Well, you started it. Imagining things? or wondering. It's much the same thing, isn't it?
We shall go on wondering, I suppose, said Tuppence, and we shan't be able to find out anything because it was all such years and years and years ago. They looked at each other.
Round about the time, we were trying to investigate the Jane Finn business, said Tommy.
They looked at each other again, their minds going back to the past.
Chapter 6 Problems.
Moving house is often thought of beforehand as an agreeable exercise which the movers are going to enjoy, but it does not always turn out as expected. Relations have to be reopened or adjusted with electricians, with builders, with carpenters, with painters, with wallpaperers, with providers of refrigerators, gas stoves, electric appliances, with upholsterers, makers of curtains, hangers-up of curtains, those who lay linoleum, those who supply carpets. Every day has not only its appointed task, but usually something between 4 and 12 extra callers, either long expected or those whose coming was quite forgotten. But there were moments when Tuppence, with sighs of relief, announced various finalities in different fields.
I really think our kitchen is almost perfect by now, she said, only I can't find the proper kind of flour bin yet.
Oh, said Tommy. Does it matter very much?
Well, it does, rather. I mean, you buy flour very often in 3-pound bags, and it won't go into these kind of containers. They're all so dainty. You know, one has a pretty rose on it, the other's got a sunflower, and they'll not take more than 1 pound. It's all so silly.
At intervals, Tuppence made other suggestions.
The Laurels, she said.
Silly name for a house, I think.
I don't see why it's called the Laurels. It hasn't got any laurels.
They could have called it the Plane Trees, much better.
Plane Trees are very nice, said Tuppence.
Before the Laurels, it was called Long Schofield, so they told me, said Tommy.
Well, that name doesn't seem to mean anything either, said Tuppence.
What's a Schofield? And who lived in it then?
I think it was the Waddingtons.
One gets so mixed, said Tuppence. Waddingtons, then the Joneses, the people who sold it to us, and before that the Blackmores. And once, I suppose, the Parkinsons. Lots of Parkinsons. I'm always running into more Parkinsons.
What way do you mean?
Well, I suppose it's that I'm always asking, said Tuppence. I mean, if I could find out something about the Parkinsons, we could get on with our problem.
That's what one always seems to call everything nowadays. The problem of Mary Jordan. Is that it?
Well, it's not just that. There's the problem of the Parkinsons, and the problem of Mary Jordan, and there must be a lot of other problems, too. Mary Jordan didn't die naturally. Then the next thing the message said was, it was one of us. Now, did that mean one of the Parkinson family? Or did it mean just someone who lived in the house? Say there were 2 or 3 Parkinsons, and some older Parkinsons, and people with different names, but who were aunts to the Parkinsons, or nephews and nieces to the Parkinsons. And I suppose something like a housemaid and a parlour maid and a cook and perhaps a governess and perhaps, well, not an au pair girl. It would be too long ago for an au pair girl, but one of us must mean a household full. Households were fuller then than they are now. Well, Mary Jordan could have been a housemaid or a parlour maid or even the cook. And why should someone want her to die and not die naturally? I mean, somebody must have wanted her to die or else her death would have been natural, wouldn't it?
I'm going to another coffee morning, the day after tomorrow, said Tuppence.
Well, you seem to be always going to coffee mornings.
Well, it's a very good way of getting to know one's neighbours, and all the people who live in the same village. After all, it's not very big, this village, and people are always talking about their old aunts or people they knew. I shall try and start on Mrs. Griffin, who is evidently a great character in the neighbourhood. I should say she ruled everyone with a rod of iron, you know. She bullied the vicar, and she bullied the doctor, and I think she bullied the district nurse, and all the rest of it.
Wouldn't the district nurse be helpful?
I don't think so. She's dead. I mean, the one who would have been here in the Parkinson's time is dead, and the one who is here now hasn't been here very long. No sort of interest in the place. I don't think she even knew a Parkinson.
I wish, said Tommy desperately, oh, how I wish that we could forget all the Parkinsons.
You mean, then we shouldn't have a problem?
Oh, dear, said Tommy. Problems again.
It's Beatrice, said Tuppence.
What's Beatrice?
Who introduced problems? Really, it's Elizabeth, the cleaning help we had before Beatrice. She
He was always coming up to me and saying, "Oh, madam, could I speak to you a minute? You see, I've got a problem." And then Beatrice began coming on Thursdays, and she must have caught it, I suppose. So she had problems, too. It's just a way of saying something. But you always call it a problem.
"All right," said Tommy. "We'll admit that so. You've got a problem. I've got a problem. We've both got problems."
He sighed and departed. Tuppence came down the stairs slowly, shaking her head. Hannibal came up to her hopefully, wagging his tail and wriggling in hopes of favours to come.
"No, Hannibal," said Tuppence. "You've had a walk. You've had your morning walk."
Hannibal intimated that she was quite mistaken. He hadn't had a walk.
"You are one of the worst liars among dogs I have ever known," said Tuppence. "You've been for a walk with Father."
Hannibal made his second attempt, which was to endeavour to show by various attitudes that any dog would have a second walk if only he had an owner who would see things in that light. Disappointed in this effort, he went down the stairs and proceeded to bark loudly and make every pretense of being about to make a sharp snap bite at a tousled-haired girl who was wielding a hoover. He did not like the hoover, and he objected to Tuppence having a lengthy conversation with Beatrice.
"Oh, don't let him bite me," said Beatrice. "He won't bite you," said Tuppence. "He only pretends he's going to." "Well, I think he'll really do it one day," said Beatrice. "By the way, madam, I wonder if I could speak to you for a moment."
"Oh," said Tuppence.
"You mean, well, you see, madam, I've got a problem."
"I thought it was that," said Tuppence.
"What sort of problem is it? And by the way, do you know any family here, or anyone who lived here at one time called Jordan?"
"Jordan, no."
"Well, I can't really say. There was the Johnsons, of course, and there was... Ah, yes, one of the constables was a Johnson, and so was one of the postmen, George Johnson. He was a friend of mine."
She giggled.
"You never heard of a Mary Jordan who died?"
Beatrice merely looked bewildered, and she shook her head and went back to the assault.
"About this problem, madam."
"Oh, yes, your problem."
"I hope you don't mind my asking you, madam, but it's put me in a queer position. You see, and I don't like..."
"Well, if you can tell me quickly," said Tuppence, "I've got to go out to a coffee morning."
"Oh, yes, at Mrs. Barber's, isn't it?"
"That's right," said Tuppence.
"Now, what's the problem?" "Well, it's a coat. Ever such a nice coat it was, and at Simmons it was, and I went in and tried it on, and it seemed to be very nice, it did, but... Well, there was one little spot on the skirt, you know, just round near the hem, but that didn't seem to me it would matter much. Anyway, well, it... Yes?" said Tuppence.
"It what?"
"It made me see why it was so inexpensive, you see, so I got it. And so that was all right. But when I got home, I found there was a label on it, and instead of saying £3.70, it was labelled £6. Well, ma'am, I didn't like to do that, so I didn't know what to do. I went back to the shop and I took the coat with me. I thought I'd better take it back and explain, you see, that I hadn't meant to take it away like that. And then, you see, the girl who sold it to me, very nice girl she is, her name's Gladys, yes. I don't know what her other name is. But anyway, she was ever so upset she was, and I said, 'Well, that's all right, I'll pay extra.' And she said, 'No, no, you can't do that, because it's all entered up, you see. You do see what I mean?'" Yes, I think I see what you mean," said Tuppence. "And so she said, 'Oh, you can't do that. It will get me into trouble.' Well, why should it get her into trouble? Well, that's what I felt. I mean to say, well, I mean, it had been sold to me for less, and I'd brought it back, and I didn't see why it could put her into trouble. She said if there was any carelessness like that, and they hadn't noticed the right ticket and they'd charged me the wrong price, as likely as not, she'd get the sack for it."
"Oh, I shouldn't think that would happen," said Tuppence. "I think you were quite right.
I don't see what else you could do." "Well, but there it is, you see. She made such a fuss, and she was beginning to cry and everything, so I took the coat away again, and now I don't know whether I've cheated the shop or whether... I don't really know what to do."
"Well," said Tuppence,
"I really think I'm too old to know what one ought to do nowadays, because everything is so odd in shops. The prices are odd, and everything's difficult. But if I were you and you want to pay something extra, well, perhaps you'd better give the money to... What's her name? Gladys something. She can put the money in the till or somewhere." "Oh, well, I don't know as I'd like to do that, because she might keep it, you see. I mean, if she kept the money, oh, well, I mean, it wouldn't be difficult, would it? Because I suppose I've stolen the money, and I wouldn't have stolen it really. I mean, then it would have been Gladys who stole it, wouldn't it? And I don't know that I trust her all that much. Oh, dear."
"Yes," said Tuppence.
"Life is very difficult, isn't it? I'm terribly sorry, Beatrice, but I really think you've got to make up your own mind about this. If you can't trust your friend... Oh, she's not exactly a friend. I only buy things there. And she's ever so nice to talk to, but I mean... Well, she's not exactly a friend, you know. I think she had a little trouble once before, the last place she was in. You know, they said she kept money back on something she'd sold.
Well, in that case, said Tuppence, in slight desperation, I shouldn't do anything.
The firmness of her tone was such that Hannibal came into the consultation. He barked loudly at Beatrice and took a running leap at the Hoover, which he considered one of his principal enemies.
I don't trust that Hoover, said Hannibal. I'd like to bite it up.
Oh, be quiet, Hannibal. Stop barking. Don't bite anything or anyone, said Tuppence. I'm going to be awfully late.
She rushed out of the house.
Problems, said Tuppence, as she went down the hill and along Orchard Road.
Going along there, she wondered, as she'd done before, if there'd ever been an orchard attached to any of the houses. It seemed unlikely nowadays. Mrs. Barber received her with great pleasure. She brought forward some very delicious-looking eclairs.
What lovely things, said Tuppence.
Did you get them at Betterby's?
Betterby's was the local confectionery shop.
Oh, no, my aunt made them. She's wonderful, you know. She does wonderful things.
Eclairs are very difficult things to make, said Tuppence. I could never succeed with them.
Well, you have to get a particular kind of flour. I believe that's the secret of it.
The ladies drank coffee and talked about the difficulties of certain kinds of home cookery.
Miss Bolland was talking about you the other day, Mrs. Beresford.
Oh, said Tuppence.
Really?
Bolland?
She lives next door to the vicarage. Her family has lived there a long time. She was telling us how she'd come and stayed here when she was a child. She used to look forward to it, she said, because there were such wonderful gooseberries in the garden, and greengage trees, too. Now, that's a thing you practically never see nowadays, not real greengages. Something else called gage plums or something, but they're not a bit the same to taste.
The ladies talked about things in the fruit line which did not taste like things used to, which they remembered from their childhood.
My great-uncle had greengage trees, said Tuppence.
Oh, yes. Is that the one who was a canon at Anchester? Canon Henderson used to live there with his sister, I believe. Very sad it was. She was eating seed cake one day, you know, and one of the seeds got the wrong way, something like that, and she choked and she choked and she choked and she died of it.
Oh, dear, that's very sad, isn't it? Said Mrs. Barber.
Very sad indeed. One of my cousins died choking, she said. A piece of mutton. It's very easy to do, I believe, and there are people who die of hiccups because they can't stop, you know.
They don't know the old rhyme, she explained.
Hiccup, hick down, hick to the next town, three hicks and one cup, sure to cure the hiccups. You have to hold your breath while you say it.